We said that a third cause for the Holocaust could have been that people had the opportunity to come to Eretz Israel, and they didn't. And because of that, Teichtel in Neim Habonim Smecha says, and others also said that idea. we explained that the it fits together with the other two reasons, that even though they seem to be a little contradictory, secular Zionism, assimilation, and not going to Eretz Israel seems not to be in whack with secular Zionism, but like we explained already, secular Zionism had nothing really to do with Eretz Israel. It was a completely different concept. Eretz Yisrael was just incidental. And secular Zionism and assimilation were very much connected. And now we'll see that not wanting to go to Eretz Yisrael or not seeing the need to go to Eretz Yisrael is also another form of assimilation. We said last week that the purpose of Eretz Yisrael was to give us a place where we could be, like we spoke about assimilation, an am levada dishko. We could be insulated from the nations of the world. It's very difficult to do that when you live amongst them. But when you have your own country, and that country is an Eretz Kedosha, and it has hashkocha pratis, and you're a nation that's kodesh and supposed to develop a lifestyle of Kedusha, and you have Hashgacha Pratis, and the land and the people fit each other, and that's the place where Klal Yisrael can ideally create a society that is insulated from the rest of the world. Anywhere else is not the ideal. Golus is an aberration, says the Maral. It's not the normal situation for Klal Yisrael. Because we did things wrong, we needed to be in the hospital, the Chafetz Chaim says. Golus is a hospital. If you're sick, it's a good place to be. But it's not the place a person should want to spend the rest of his life in a hospital. So, understanding that the ideal is that Klal Yisrael should be in Eretz Yisrael and create the kind of society that Eretz Yisrael is conducive to. And that's what we're going to discuss tonight, what that is. Last time, we said that why was Eretz Yisrael, why did the Torah start with Bereishis? In order to tell us that we have a claim on Eretz Yisrael. We asked a lot of questions. Right? Why do we need to be told that in the beginning of the Torah? Could have been at the end of the Torah as a footnote. Also, it's mashma that we need this to answer the Goyim in case they claim that we stole their land. They won't listen to it anyway. And even in history, when we had the opportunity, we didn't use this. So we explained last week that the reason HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us Eretz Yisrael, at least that's my understanding, the reason HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us Eretz Yisrael in such a suspicious way that we had to conquer seven nations, kill their men, women, and children, the ones that did not want to leave. And then we need Bereishis Bara Elohim to tell us that we're not murderers and we're not robbers, but the Ribbono Shel Olam is the one who decides what's moral and not. And by the way, I don't think we mentioned it last week, but this question is asked many times. Why was Yehoshua different, Lahavdil Elef Havdolos, but than Hitler? Yehoshua also killed men, women, and children, and committed genocide. And the answer that people sometimes give, well, Yehoshua gave them the ability to leave. He sent letters before they crossed the Yarden, and he said that we're coming to fight you, and we have a mitzvah to kill every man, woman, and child, so we suggest that you leave. So the Girgashi left. The ones that didn't leave, so they chose to stay, so we killed men, women, and children. That's not a good answer. Because Lamaisa, still, why do we kill women and children? Just because they didn't listen and they decided to leave? The only answer is that God told us to do it. And God, who gave these people life, had a right to tell us to take away their life. It's the only answer. It's the only difference. God didn't tell Hitler to do what he did. And if he claims he did, which he doesn't, but there are other goyim that do claim that, the Inquisition or whatever, then Lashon Lavo, God will reveal who he told and who he didn't tell. It's the only difference. No other differences. No logical, moral, ethical answer to that question, except that the God who created the world has a right to do what he wants with this world. And if he wants us to kill men, women, and children, he wants us to kill Aramalek, he wants us to kill the seven nations, right, then that's his prerogative. It's no one else's prerogative, and if you don't believe that God said it, you have a big problem. And if somebody else thinks that God told him, he has a big problem. Because eventually God will, right? God knows who he told and who he didn't tell. It's the only difference. There's absolutely no other difference. So, therefore, the Torah demanded of us that we set our values and standards on God. We have no choice. Because before you can start a mitzvah in the Torah, you have to have the right values and standards. And that we explained, that we're going to explain it more tonight in more detail. But if you have the wrong standards and values, you can't do mitzvahs. I think I quoted Rabbi Hollander last week. Today I'm going to explain a little bit more. That a person who has basically the same standards and values of the secular world, but he wants to be from, so he doesn't have 613 mitzvahs. He has 613 problems. Because every mitzvah conflicts with his lifestyle, with his standards, his values, or whatever. So before you can fulfill mitzvahs, you need to have the right outlook on life. And then the mitzvahs fit perfectly. But if you don't, the mitzvahs are very, very difficult. And we've explained in the past that that answers the seeming contradiction between the Vilna Gaon and the Dubna Maggid. Without going into great detail, the Dubna Maggid says that if mitzvahs are too hard to do, then it's a sign you're not doing them right, because mitzvahs are easy to do. If you have too much trouble doing them, you're obviously not doing them the right way. And the Vilna Gaon says just the opposite. If a mitzvah comes too easily, it's obviously not a mitzvah that's really l'shem shamayim. Because if you really be doing the mitzvah properly, it wouldn't be easy. The Yetzer Hara, the Satan, wouldn't give in so easily. He puts up a big fight when the mitzvah is really proper, and he doesn't put up such a fight when the mitzvah is not so proper. So they seem to be at total odds. The Vilna Gaon says that the mitzvah is too easy, it's a symbol that it's not being done properly. And the Dubna Maggid says the mitzvah is too hard, it's a symbol that it's not being done properly. And we've explained in the past that they're talking about two different things. And the sources where they say it seem to uphold that. The Vilna Gaon is talking about this idea of accepting a Torah lifestyle. The values, the standards, the perspectives, that is extremely difficult. It's very difficult to get the right perspective on life. And the Satan doesn't give in. But once you have that, then the Dubna Maggid kicks in, that mitzvahs then in that environment, with that perspective, are easy. Then they're easy. They're easy when they're done in the environment, within the framework that they were meant to be done. They're very difficult if they're done outside that framework. And I'll give you two examples that I'd like to give. Take two high school bachurim in America. Here it loses its, I don't even say this, Marshall, most places here, if I speak in Hebrew, for sure not. But Americans can appreciate America, it's a Marshall. Two American yeshiva bachrim, and I have the right to make up the Marshall any way I want, so it's black and white, okay? All the conditions I'm going to give are given. So it's not confusing, and there's no gray areas, I tailor-made the marshal to what I want to bring out. These two bachrim, if they will stay and sit and learn for years after high school and not go to college and not pursue any other career but stay by learning full-time, will be the next leaders of the generation. 100% for sure. How do I know? I made up the marshal. Right? They will be the next chazon ish of the generation, for sure. Okay, so there's no gray areas over here, that's for sure. If they don't, and they go and decide they need a parnassa, and they go become doctors, lawyers, accountants, whatever. So they'll be very fine balabatim, very fine b'nei Torah, but they won't be the two gedolei Yisrael that they could be. Okay. And therefore, it would seem that if everybody would know what I know, right, that anybody who would have to advise these two young men should be, they should stay by Torah. They have an achrayus to Klal Yisrael, they could become gedolei Yisrael. Here there's no shaila. I don't think anybody would disagree. These two people, right, have a responsibility to themselves, to Klal Yisrael, whatever it may be, they should stay by Torah. Now they have different influences. Some of the relatives, maybe, parents, uncles, aunts, maybe are telling them, look, you know, Torah is nice, but you need a parnasa, and how are you going to live, and you should maybe get a parnasa. And the rebbeim are telling them, we see in you, you have the power to be the next gedolei Yisrael, stay by learning. And they have a dilemma, they have a choice to make. Now, let's have the next point. These two boys come from two different backgrounds. One that we're familiar with, and the other that almost doesn't exist. But that's, in my marshal, that's the marshal. One comes from the society we're familiar with. Right? If you would ask a secular person, a non-Jew, and we'll see even a frum person, in the society that we live in, how he would define success, I guarantee you 99% of people would say success is money, power, fame. All boils down to money. When you have money, then you have power, you have fame, and you have money. And basically, even though we don't believe that, right? If you'd ask the Torah what success is obviously not doing money. There are a lot of successful people in this world, right, who had lives that got them the most olam haba because they had the right kind of midos and they did mitzvahs and they learned Torah, and that's a successful life. And they were not rich at all. They had no money. So money is not a factor at all from a Torah standpoint. But from a secular standpoint, it's a big factor. That success is probably spelled with a dollar sign, not an S. So, but we all grew up in that society. All of us. And therefore, when we hear the word success, if you're honest, you admit that your knee-jerk reaction is money. And then you stop and you say, no, but I know that's not true. I know that that's just, you know, what it looks like, but it's not true. But you have to think about it. The second intellectual answer that says it's not true. But your immediate reaction is like everybody else. Because how could it not be? We were all brought up, no matter where, how frum you were when you were born, right, and your parents and whatever, but we grew up in a society where every billboard, right, implied that if you buy that car, you'll be successful, and had all the accoutrements of success around this car, or this chewing gum, or whatever it was. And every advertisement you ever heard, everything pointed to that fact. If you want success, you want to be rich, you want to be famous, you want to be comfortable, then just chew this gum, buy this car, right, or whatever. And that's the next lesson that we got by osmosis. So it's there, you can't avoid it. But we know, intellectually, it's not true. More, some less. Because of what we learned, because of what we believe. Now, that's the one boy grew up in our society. The other one grew up in a different society. He grew up in a totally Torah environment. That means from the time that he was born, facetiously speaking, every billboard he saw had the following. It had that new car, and around it was, if you buy this car, it will help your midos, right? You'll probably learn Torah better, and you'll do more mitzvahs. So buy this car because this will encourage a Torah life. So success in his mind was embedded with Torah, mitzvahs, midos, tovos, or whatever. Okay. So from the cradle, he lived in a society where those were the standards and the values. Now you can understand that the nisayon that these two individuals will have is completely different. Right? The one who grew up in our society has a real test. He's going to have to sacrifice success for Torah. That's a big choice. He may do it, but it was difficult. The other one doesn't have a great test altogether, because Torah is success. Why would I want to give up success to go to college? So for him, it's the success is defined by what the right choice is. So he's trying to do something based on a framework that's conducive to the right choice. And the other one, the base, is not conducive. So the right choice is difficult. He may still make the right choice, but it's going to be difficult. So you see how standards and values make Torah either easier or more difficult. Now do something for the women. You're all aware that there are women today that feel cheated, discriminated against by none other than the Torah. They blame it sometimes on the rabbis, but can't blame everything on the rabbi. Most things, yeah, but not everything, right? It's not the rabbis that they have a problem with, it's God. Because if you believe in the Torah, then you'd believe that the rabbis didn't make this up, that they're just reporting what the Rabbanu Shalom said. So it's God who said, women don't put on tefillin, they don't wear tzitzis, and they don't have to get up at 10 to 6 in the morning and go to a minyan every day, right? And that's really discrimination. I would love all these women to have to go, and I could stay in bed, right? I feel discriminated against, to tell you the truth. But in any case, there are women who feel discriminated, that they can't, they'll do all these things, they can't be a shliach tzibur and daven for the Ahmed, and they can't, what's it called, sing their kishkes out at the Kosul Maravi on Rosh Chodesh or whatever, and it's really discriminatory. Okay, their time is on the Rabbanu Shalom. Now, I don't want to make this an issue that everybody has the same motivation, but I'm going to tell you what I think is one motivation that applies pretty much across the board. There are many different other things. It's hard for me to accept that these women are cool of a shame shamai. In other words, they are so spiritual that it really bothers them that they can't have a closer relationship with God. And tefillin, tzitzis, and davening for the Amid, and whatever is the way that you can have a close relationship with God, and that's denied to them. I'll tell you why I can't accept that, but that can't be the main reason. Because that would imply that our great-grandmothers, that didn't bother them. Right? They didn't want to have a connection with God. The Chazon Ish's mother, who if you ever read a biography of the Chazon Ish, know that he became the Chazon Ish because of the kind of mother that he had, right? Didn't ever bother her that she can't go and sing her kishkas out at the Kosel Maravi, right? She couldn't get to the Kosel Maravi, but whatever, right? That didn't bother her. Didn't bother her that she couldn't get up and put on tefillin or wear a talis. Why? Because she wasn't a spiritual woman, right? She was just interested in sitting in the kitchen making chocolate cakes. But today's women are so spiritual that it really bothers them, right? I find that hard to swallow. Okay, I'm not saying that the women themselves don't have good motivations or whatever, distorted, misled, misguided, but perhaps good. I don't discount that. But I think there's something deeper that makes it like that. And that's the following. If you would ask in the secular world, okay, is fame a value to itself, people will tell you yes. People, I'll give you an example. Give to a person two choices, right? You have a magic wand, and I have a magic wand, and I can give you one of two professions. You can be a movie actor or movie actress, and everybody will know your face, your name. You'll be a household word. You won't have all that much talent and intelligence, but you'll be a good actor, and you'll make a lot of money, and everybody will know who you are. That's one wave of the magic wand. Or, I could wave my magic wand, and you will be a director, producer. You're the guy who comes at the end of the movie in those little prints that nobody ever reads. You make the scenery, you make the, what's it called, you write the script. Nobody knows who you are. You have a lot more talent. You maybe will make the same amount of money. Let's not make money in Indian. You make the same money, just one difference. If you're the actor, you're the actress, your name is a household word. And if you're the talented screenwriter, whatever, nobody knows who you are. Same money, more talent on this end. I guarantee you 99% of people, right, will choose the first one. Because fame is an intrinsic value in the secular world. It's a value to be famous. And in Cleveland, when I was learning there, I remember reading in the paper that somebody murdered his neighbor. And the police couldn't find a motive. They finally caught the guy, and they could not find a motive. And it wasn't even too hard to catch him. And finally, he admitted why he murdered his neighbor. He had no reason except that he wanted to be famous, and he knew that murderers get their picture on the front page. And he'd be talked about by everybody, and everybody would know who he was. It was kedai for him to murder and go through the whole thing to be famous. Okay, obviously that's an extreme to the sick point. But that's, in a secular world, fame is a value to itself, an intrinsic value. In a Torah perspective, fame could be something that's positive, but it's not an intrinsic value, just the opposite. Intrinsically, it's better not to be famous, because the things that are more tzanua, things that are not so famous, have a bracha, like the Chazon Ish. Till he was 40 years old, except for Reb Chaim Ozer in Vilna, nobody knew who he was. He sat and learned in a base medrash with a chavrusa. Right? He wasn't well known. He already wrote the Chazon Ish, never put his name on it, only hinted Ish, and not even his last name's hint. Aleph Yud Shin was just his first name, Avram Shaya. He made Reb Chaim Ozer promise that he would not reveal who he was, what he was, or whatever. He just wanted to sit and learn in peace, somewhere in her eye and hidden from view, so he'd have a bigger bracha. When time came and he was going to Eretz Yisrael, then the Gedolim, the Chofetz Chaim, Reb Chaim Ozer, forced him to become famous. Because they said in Eretz Yisrael, they need leadership, you must reveal who you are, and there you have to take over the reins of leadership. And then he became the famous Chazon Ish. If he had his druthers, he would have remained in the background. I'll prove it to you. The holiest place in the world, right, is what? The Kodesh HaKadoshim. Do you think there was ever a spread in Better Homes and Gardens on the interior decor of the Kodesh HaKadoshim? I guarantee you not. Nobody ever saw the inside except the Kohen Gadol once a year, and even there was a smoke screen. He never even got to see what it was. It was totally hidden from view. Yet that was the Kodesh HaKadoshim. So from a Torah standpoint, it's intrinsically more valuable to be hidden. But if there's a purpose not to be hidden, so then there's an inyan like that too. But it's not a value to be famous. Just the opposite. So the Chazon, a woman whose role is behind the scenes most of the time, right? If she has a Torah value system, can't complain about that. That's just the opposite. Men should complain. How come I'm thrust into the limelight? Why come I have to daven for the omid? How come I have to be out there in the limelight? Why can't I be behind the scenes? If anything, somebody who has a real Torah outlook, the men should complain, not the women. But if you're brought up in a society where fame is a value, then you feel cheated. I am not the one in the forefront. I'm the one in the background. How come? But it's not because the Torah discriminates. It's because I have a value system that's foreign to the Torah. And according to the value system, what the Torah demands of me is oppressive. It's discriminatory. So you're trying to put a round thing on a square base. It doesn't fit. Of course you feel, discriminated against. So, again, that may not be the only reason that people feel like that. But it's definitely a cause. It's one of the root causes of this problem.
That would only apply to the Kosel. The other mitzvahs, the tefillin.
No, still, these are all things that people, they get an aliyah, whatever. Okay, enechanami. There's other things besides faith. Right? There's things of being told what you can do and what you can't do. That's also, there's from the secular world, right? Nobody tells me what to do. I want to be egalitarian. Right? I want to decide for myself. I create my role. Everybody's role can be the same. Right? The idea that there's roles that are dictated by an authority, that is foreign to a secular world. So that's another aspect. Same thing. If you have standards and values that are secular, secular meaning not Torah, then it's going to be hard to keep the Torah, because the Torah doesn't fit those values and standards. But not because there's something wrong with the Torah, it's because there's a conflict. But if you had Torah standards and values, if you looked at things the way the Torah looks at them, there would be no conflict. They'd be happy with what the... That's so it's clear like that. That it's not a matter of just doing things, but the framework in which they're done is very important. So therefore, the Torah said, before you can start the first mitzvah, you need to have the understanding that God made this world, and He determines what's right and what's wrong. And He determines what's positive, what's negative, what's a value, what's not a value. And if you accept that, then you can have mitzvahs. If not, you're going to have a hard time keeping mitzvahs. Also, if you accept that, then you have a claim on Eretz Yisrael for yourself. Not for the Goyim. For us. He told us. Because we have to know that we have a claim on Eretz Yisrael. Because the whole purpose of Eretz Yisrael is to create a society where all the values and standards are based on Torah. Now, if you understand that your values and standards have to be based on the Ribbono Shel Olam, then you need Eretz Yisrael. Because you're going to create a society where that's the case. But if you don't know that, then you don't need Eretz Yisrael. And you have no claim on it. Because in the eyes, if you want to make your standards and values depend on the nations of the world, then they think you're a murderer and a robber. If you want to make them dependent on the Ribbono Shel Olam, He told you to do it. So if you can't accept that your standards and values have to be based on God, and you base them on other considerations, then you have no claim to Eretz Yisrael. You're talking a bunch of murderers and robbers. And you don't need a claim on Eretz Yisrael, because the whole purpose of Eretz Yisrael is to create a society where the values and the standards are based on the Ribbono Shel Olam. So it all goes together. And that has to be clear before you have the first mitzvah, otherwise mitzvahs are impossible. That's the idea. Now, if that's the case, so what is ultimately, bottom line, the tachlis of Eretz Yisrael? Why did the Ribbono Shel Olam give us this land? So we can create a society here that the values, the standards, is all based on the Ribbono Shel Olam, and we can create a society that is not like the rest of the nations of the world, the antithesis of secular Zionism. We can create a society that's different than the rest of the nations of the world, where we live a life of Kedusha, this we explained last week, and they have to live a life of morality. And even if everybody's doing exactly what they're supposed to, and the nations of the world are tzaddikim, and they all get Olam Haba, they're still only moral. They don't have to be Kodesh. We have to be Kodesh. I gave you an example last week about the difference between Kedusha and morality. I'll give you another example. I was going to quote this last week, and I don't know if he... did this on purpose, or he's a Navi, but Rafi sent me an article from the Jewish News of Greater Phoenix, which is exactly what I wanted to say last week. For some reason, I didn't say it, but it's good, because this is much better. To tell you the difference, last week I gave you an example with Yichud. This week I'll give you something more, which I think is a better example. And that's with business ethics. Morality, there's this guy, Aaron Feuerstein. He was, I'll read you what it says here. He was a CEO of Malden Mills in Massachusetts. And he was thrust into the national spotlight when a fire nearly destroyed his textile factories. I thought he had hundreds of workers, tens of workers. He had 2,400 workers. Demonstrating an all too uncommon loyalty to his 2,400 workers, he continued paying them for 90 days at a cost of $1.5 million per week while the factories were being rebuilt. Now, that means, more morally speaking, right, this guy employed 2,400 workers, and most of them were goyim. Okay, we're not talking about a frum Jew, and this guy was a frum Jew, you know, with other frum Jews. He was dealing with goyim. Morally speaking, his business burned to the ground. He didn't have a textile mill anymore. He didn't have a business. He couldn't employ anybody. He didn't have a business. So morally, nobody would have had any kindness on him if he said to all his workers, you know, it's been nice knowing you, and I really, you know, enjoyed having you work for me when I had a business. except I don't have any business anymore, and therefore I don't have any more workers. So all of you should go find other jobs. If you can't, and I build back my business, I'd be more than happy to hire you back. See me when my business is built. Okay? And obviously from here it took him 3 months to build up the business again. For those 3 months, he kept every single one of those people on the payroll. I didn't think he paid them. I thought he just kept them on the payroll. They shouldn't lose their, benefits, medical benefits, and what?
Right.
Right, whatever. Right? He kept them all on the payroll for 90 days while the business was being rebuilt, and it cost him $1.5 million every week. He also gave generously to support charities that helped the families of 9 critically injured workers who have since recovered. Now, every media around the world picked this up. It was famous at the time. And they saw this as a Kiddush Hashem. Now, here's a religious Jew who, morally speaking, didn't have any responsibility to these people. Morally. But he went beyond what was moral. That's the way a Jew has to be. Right? And that's in business. You have to be Kodesh. Not the opposite. Rahman al-Islam, a lot of times it works the other way. That the Jew, in one of the archaic meanings in the dictionary, means to cheat. To Jew somebody. Right? Means to cheat him. Not that we deserve it necessarily, but some people do. So that's the opposite. That's a Chilul Hashem. Then you can be moral. And then you can make a Kiddush Hashem because you do something that's Kodesh and not just moral. This is Kedusha. Right? This is something that, again, you can see when the nations of the world say, if we all lived like that, and we had a society where this was what business was, you could see what a Kiddush Hashem will make in the world. That doesn't mean that Goyim have to go do that. They don't. They have to be moral, but at least they have an incentive to be moral if they see that there's holy, divine people in this world who represent godliness in every area. So that's what Eretz Yisrael is all about, to create a society where every area of life, whether it be economical, marriage, social, political, every area of life is done in a way that's more than moral. In order to do that, we have to be insulated from the rest of the world. Because otherwise, we'll all reach the lowest common denominator, and that means that even if the Goyim are doing exactly what they're supposed to be doing, it's still not what we're supposed to be doing. We're supposed to be beyond that. Halavai, we should be on that level. But we're supposed to be beyond that. And that's the goal. It's thinking that that explains the following. The Vilna Gaon. Well, let me start with the Kasha, and we'll hopefully be able to finish this. The Torah says, "Lo yachmod ish es artzecha, ba'alos ha'leiros es pnei Hashem elokecha shalosh pamim b'shana." That nobody's going to covet, nobody's going to be jealous of your land when you go up to Yerushalayim 3 times a year. Now, the simple meaning of that is that we have a problem. The Torah said that every male, right, bar mitzvah and under bar mitzvah, whose educational age, has to go up Shalosh Regalim to Yerushalayim. Okay. That means if all the males go, right, who anybody of an educational age, the women also go. Because what, all the women are going to stay home when the men go to spend Yom Tov in Yerushalayim? It's absurd. Especially Pesach, they have to go because of Korban Pesach. But even Shavuos and Sukkot, the women are going to go too. They also have to be part of Simchas Yom Tov. Right? The man's not going to go away from his family, right? Especially since he has to take his educational age kids. He's surely not going to go without his wife, okay, alone with those kids. That I can vouch for. He's going to go with his wife. And so everybody leaves. Everybody packs up. The whole Israel packs up and goes to Yerushalayim. So Goyim aren't that stupid. Right? After a few years, or even after a few Yomim Tovim, they're going to say, hey, this is great. You know, all the Jews are in Yerushalayim. And everybody left their household, their homestead, unguarded. There's no guards. The policemen also have to go, because they're also from. Right? And all the soldiers have to go. Everybody has to spend Yom Tov in Yerushalayim. There's nobody exempt. So everybody's in Yerushalayim. So the Rosh Hashanah says, don't worry. I'll give you a bracha that when you go up three times a year, nobody's going to want your land. It's going to be a miracle. Nobody's going to want your land. So he's bothering me. Why is the Rabbanu Shlomo to promise us that nobody will want the land? I don't care if they want it or not. Just tell me they won't take it. Right? Just promise me they won't take it. Why if they promise you they don't want it? What do I care if they want it or don't want it? So I think there's a different meaning completely. That's the following. What's the purpose of going up to Yerushalayim three times a year, Aliyah Lerenu? So you can understand it in the following way. The nusach of benching that we have for Alamichya, nusach Ashkenaz, and nusach Svard is different than nusach Agra, which is also the same thing as nusach Balatanya. Okay, I know there's somebody here down in nusach Balatanya. And anybody down in nusach Agra? No, I don't think so. Okay, but in any case, you'll see if this is your nusach, you'll be familiar to you. Our nusach, meaning the ones who don't daven nusach Agro and nusach Balatanya, so our nusach is the following: Ala Michyo, Ala Kalkolo, Ala Tmulasa Soda, Ala Eretzchem de Tova Rechova, Shratzisa, Vinchalt Lavoseinu, Lecho, Vipirio, Velispo, Mituva. Rachem no Hashem Elokeinu Yisrael Amecha, V'al Yishlami Recha, V'al Tzio Mishkan Kvodecha, V'al Nizbechecha, V'al Heicholecha, U'v'nei Yerushalayim Yerakodesh Meher V'yomenu, V'aleinu L'socha, V'samcheinu V'inyona, V'nochal Mipirya, V'nizba Mituva. Okay, that's Walz Nogeya. That's our Nusach. The Nusach HaGroa, which is the same Nusach of the Balatanian, is based on a Shitas HaGaonim in the Tur. They both paskin like that Shita. They leave out that last phrase that we said. When it says, the nocha mipirya, the nisba mituva, right, they leave it out. They don't say that. What they say is, v'aleinu l'socha v'samchein v'yana, rachim l'ashem l'keinu yisro necha. They skip that whole phrase, the nocha mipirya, the nisba mituva. The reason they skip it is because the Gemara says in Sota, the Gemara asked the following question: why did Moshe Rabbeinu want to go into Eretz Yisrael? The chilech of the period, sorry, because he wanted to eat some nice fruit. Of course, that wasn't the motivation of Moshe Rabbeinu to go into Eretz Yisrael. Ella, he wanted to do all these extra mitzvahs. The Gemara says with such a bittle, in such a derogative way, that wanting to go to Eretz Yisrael to eat the fruit is such a like nothing, no, like that's a no. That's not why Moshe Rabbeinu would want to go into Eretz Yisrael. So therefore, how in the world can you say in Alamichya, right, Ba'aleinu l'socha, v'samcheinu v'nyonah, v'nochal, that we should eat the fruit. That's not a motivation to go to Eretz Yisrael. We can't put in a tefillah, please, Rabbanu Shlomo, bring us to Eretz Yisrael, so we should be able to eat the fruit. The Gemara says that's a negative thing. So they leave it out. Why we say it, that's a separate thing, it's not for this year. There's a Bach there, you can look it up and see, he says an interesting idea. But there's only one big problem. With the Nusach HaGro and the Nusach Balatanya, they do say the same thing in the beginning of the bracha. Ala Michyav al Kakol of Avnu Vasasode, Ve'al Eretz Chem the Tover Chover Shratzisa V'nchalkel of Oseinu Lecho Mipirio V'Zvomituba. And God gave us the land to eat the fruit. We said that that's not a motivation for the land to eat fruit. So why do they say it? And they do say that in the beginning of the bracha. Why in the beginning of the bracha do they say it and not in the end? So the simple answer could be, in the beginning, we're saying why HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us the land. And we're thanking Him, He gave us for fruit too. And the other one, we're davening why we want the land. Then we don't mention the fruit. But the fact that the Rabbanu Shlomo gave us that great fruit, we thank Him for it. Okay. But I have a much deeper answer, which I think is more understood. And that's the following. The Gemara says in Pesachim, why didn't the Rabbanu Shlomo put Tveria, the hot springs of Tveria in Yerushalayim? Why are they in Tveria? Wouldn't it have been a covet to Yerushalayim if they had hot springs? Anybody who's ever lived in Yerushalayim knows it's hard enough to get a hot bath there, b'chlal. Right? Hot water is a commodity. Had there been the hot springs, it would have been very nice in Yerushalayim. Also, the Peros Gedusa, the Peros of the Galil, lush fruit. Why wasn't that in Yerushalayim? Why did God put it in the Galil? Why didn't He give covet to Yerushalayim that Yerushalayim should have all this luscious fruit? Yerushalayim is not known for its fruit. Doesn't have hot springs. Why not? Says the Gemara, Because three times a year you have to go to Yerushalayim, Aliyah Lorenzo. God wants you to go to Shem Shemayim. Not for the good fruit and for a hot bath. The hot bath you can get in Tveria. The good fruit you get in the Galil. Yerushalayim you get Ruchnius. He wants you to go for the Shem Shemayim. But the hot springs do exist in Tveria. And the good fruit is in the Galil. That means that in Yerushalayim it's not an Indian, but in the rest of Eretz Yisrael it is. Why? Because Eretz Yisrael, like we said, is the place to create a lifestyle where everything, eating fruit and taking a bath, everything, is done l'shem shamayim with kedusha. So you're supposed to live a life where you eat fruit and you have all the professions and all the accoutrements of a normal life, except you do it b'kedusha. But how do you know how to do it b'kedusha? So three times a year you go up to Yerushalayim, where it's kulo kodesh, and you learn from Yerushalayim how to apply those principles to your mundane, everyday life when you go back home. But then you elevate the fruit to Kedusha, and you elevate the hot bath to Kedusha. How do you know how to do that? By going to Yerushalayim three times a year and learning the lesson. So Yerushalayim is the place where you learn the lesson. That's kulo kodesh. That's total ruchnius. The rest of Eretz Yisrael has all the gashmias too, because that's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to apply that ruchnias to your gashmiastic alike. Therefore, the first part of the bracha is talking about Eretz Yisrael in general. Eretz chemda tova urechava, a good, choice, desirable land, shiratziso, which you wanted, binchalta, and you gave it to our ancestors, lechom imperial zvaituva. Eretz Yisrael in general, the fruit, and the goodness, the physical goodness is fine. That's what it's for. But the second part of the bracha speaks specifically about Yerushalayim. Uvenei Yerushalayim yirakodesh mherev yameinu. Ba'aleinu l'socha into Yerushalayim. V'samcheinu b'vinyonah, binyan Yerushalayim. There you don't say about the fruit. I'm Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu was a Levi. Had he gone to Eretz Yisrael, he would have lived in Yerushalayim with the Kohanim and Levim. So Moshe Rabbeinu didn't want to go to Eretz Yisrael to eat the fruit. But everybody else who lives in other places, that's a good motivation. Nothing wrong with that. I want to eat the good fruit of Eretz Yisrael and do it the Kedusha. But in Yerushalayim, there I have to concentrate kulo kodesh, because that's where you learn the lesson. So for Moshe Rabbeinu, it wasn't the right thing. But for people who are not going to live in Yerushalayim, right, the rest of the Shvatim, it was a fine thing. So in the beginning of the bracha, we speak about Eretz Yisrael in general, we say the fruit. In the end of the bracha, we speak about Yerushalayim specifically, there we don't mention the fruit. If that's the case, the purpose of going up to Yerushalayim three times a year is to learn how to apply what Kedusha is and how to apply it to your everyday life. How to live a life, an economic life, that you're Kodesh. You're not just moral. A married life. A social life. Whatever it may be. That's the reason you go up. So the Rambam said like this. One more prat. The Ibn Ezra asks a question. He says, how could there be a prohibition in the Torah not to covet somebody else? Lo sachmod. Right? It's like something impossible to control. You see something somebody has, right? He has a nice tape recorder, I want it. Right? It's automatic. The Torah said, don't take it, whatever, but not want it. It's like it's how do you control such a thing? Says the Ibn Ezra, if you have the right hashkafa, again, if you have the right outlook on life, that mitzvah is easy to do. It's because you don't have the right hashkafa that the mitzvah is hard. Meaning the following. He gives a marshal with a peasant and a princess. We don't have peasants, we have princesses. So I'm going to give you another marshal, which I think brings it out more relevant to us. The basic point is, people overcome it what they think is in their league. But if it's out of their league, there's nothing to covet. Right? A peasant who knows he's never going to marry the king's daughter doesn't covet the king's daughter. Doesn't covet the prince who has a princess. It's out of his league. Right? He may covet his neighbor's wife, but not the princess. Not the queen. It's out of his league. Okay, just to bring it down to more, I always like to give the following marshal. You have a doctor and a shoemaker that are neighbors. And the doctor buys a state-of-the-art ultrasound machine. It used to be x-ray machine, but the marshal's also changed. he gets the state-of-the-art ultrasound machine. And the shoemaker gets a state-of-the-art sewing machine. Now, do you think this doctor is going to covet the shoemaker's sewing machine? Wow, I wish I had a sewing machine like that. What does he need a sewing machine for? If he sews up his patient for the sewing machine, he's not going to be a doctor too long. So he doesn't need the sewing machine. Do you think the shoemaker is going to covet the doctor's ultrasound machine? Oh, I wish I had an ultrasound machine. What does he need an ultrasound machine for? He knows what's in his shoes, feet. Well, he doesn't need an ultrasound machine. So there's not going to be any jealousy between the doctor and the shoemaker because each one knows that's not my profession. I don't need that. It's not in my league, bichlal. Neither one's going to covet. But let another doctor get a better ultrasound machine, or another shoemaker get a better sewing machine, then there's going to be jealousy between the doctors and between the shoemakers. Memela, says the Ibn Ezra, if you have the right philosophy on life, a Torah philosophy, that everything a person has is given to him by God because that is what he needs for his role in this world. It's like a play. Everybody was created to serve a different part in the play. And you get a costume, that's called your body, and you get props to fill your part. So your neshama is made a certain way, your body is made a certain way, your props are a certain kind of props, and that's for your part. Right? So if you're the king in the play, right, you have one costume and one prop, you have a sharvit, a scepter, and that's your part. If you're court jester, you may have 10 props and 10 clings. But it's not that the court jester has more than he needs. He has what he needs. You have what you need. And it doesn't make a difference who has more parts, more props or not. That doesn't necessarily mean that you have a bigger part or a better part. You just have a different part. So if everybody would have the right Torah philosophy, that what God gives me is what I need for my part in this world. And if I don't have it, I don't need it. And if I have it, I have to use it. And if somebody has something different, it's not shy, it's not my part. So how could there ever be any kind of jealousy? It's out of my league. It's the doctor and the shoemaker. If you had that hashkafa about everything, there would be no place to have kina, to have losachma. Mela, the Torah says like this. If you go up to Yerushalayim 3 times a year, and you learn what it means to live a life of kedusha, and you come back home, and you apply that to your everyday life, and you live as a nation a life of kedusha in Eretz Yisrael, then I promise you, lo yachmod ish es artzecha, none of the goyim will ever want your land. Why? Because they'll see clearly it's not for them. This land is conducive for people who want to live a holy existence the way the Torah explains holiness. No goy in the world wants to live that kind of existence. Nobody. Either they have a distorted idea of what holiness is, or they don't want to be holy altogether. They don't have to be holy. So if you live in Eretz Yisrael, the kind of life that is conducive by going 3 times a year to Yerushalayim and bringing and applying that to your life, then I promise you, lo yachmo, it's not a miracle. They won't want your land. They'll say, this land is great for people who want to live this kind of lifestyle. We don't want to live that kind of lifestyle. We'll find another land. But if you live in Eretz Yisrael, the same secular existence that the Goyim do, then why shouldn't they want the land? Then, same as there. Same lifestyle. It's a nice land. Why shouldn't we want the land? It's obviously conducive to this kind of lifestyle. That's what the Torah is telling us. If you live the way you learn in Yerushalayim and apply that to your life, then you'll have the security in Eretz Yisrael. The antithesis of secular Zionism. They wanted to cure anti-Semitism by being normal, like all the other nations. And that was the purpose. The Torah is telling us, no, if you'll be like all the other nations, you're just going to cause more anti-Semitism. But if you want to cure anti-Semitism, then you create in Eretz Yisrael a lifestyle that is so different than everybody else, nobody's going to want to be like you, right? They may be influenced by you to live their kind of life. And they may look up to you, but they'll see that the land isn't for them, because the land is conducive to this kind of lifestyle. That's not their lifestyle. So it will improve relationships. It'll make it that they won't want your land. They won't come and take it for sure. And the Mele, you'll be able to coexist with the nations of the world in a very positive way. So, therefore, if somebody doesn't want to leave Golis, when he has the opportunity, and to go to Eretz Yisrael, and again, we're oversimplifying it, but it definitely has this point. For many other reasons, why not? If the other reasons were the equal reasons, fine. But if there are many people who could easily live in Eretz Yisrael, and could easily live a more Torah-dic life, but they don't want to leave Chutz La'aretz because they're assimilated. They may be from, super from. But the values, the standards, the goals, it's the same as the Goyim. It's just kosherized. Right? It's the Bahamas and the French restaurants and whatever. And again, there's nothing wrong with that. But when that becomes the ikkar, and that becomes the goal, and it's just you have to do it kosher, then there's something wrong. Then that's assimilation. You don't have to be married to a Goy or a Goya to be assimilated. You can be assimilated to the values and the standards of the secular world. And sometimes leaving the secular world for a society that's more Jewish and more Torah-oriented, and here you surely can find that, right? I'm not going to equate it to today. But for sure, what the ideal is, this is where we can create a different kind of society, and some people don't want that. Deep down, they'd rather have the society they're in, right, and don't want to give that up. And that's also a form of assimilation. It's a very refined and subtle assimilation, but it may be even worse. Because the real assimilation you know is assimilation. This one you don't see. This one is the deadly, silent killer. So therefore, all three things, secular Zionism, assimilation, and people who resisted going to Eretz Yisrael where all of the other circumstances were positive, all boiled down to the same thing, assimilation. And therefore, assimilation is a root cause of tzaras for Klal Yisrael, like we learned. And that's why the Rebbeinu Shlom unleashes anti-Semitism to keep Jews from assimilating on a long-term basis and making it impossible. So what seemed to be separate ideas, and even contradictory, the way we've explained it, all come from the same basic root. Okay, Tanda Nishlam, and next week we start with continuing with this idea of ideas, but it's going to be much shorter to the point, short things, and we'll go back to Halacha also, Mir Tashem.